Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello and welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high quality continuing education and professional development for all UK registered optometrists. You can gain 1 point by listening to this podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and an examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. In this episode, we'll be focusing on how to recognise vitreomacular disorders and how to decide when referral is indicated. I'll be speaking to Mr. Cam Balaghan, consultant vitreoretinal and cataract surgeon.
Don't refer a patient just on the basis of a symptom, on the basis of the OCT scan. It's really crucial that you pattern recognise, put everything together and make that decision.
But first, one of our producers, Dr. Hilary Guyte, found out about one patient's experience with a vitreomacular disorder.
My name's Andy Parks. I'm 61 years old. And in 2018, December, I was diagnosed with epiretinal membrane and retinal tears.
Let's start from the beginning. When did you start to notice that something was wrong with your eye?
It was both eyes. It was in 2017 in October when I suddenly became far more aware of black patches in the right eye. I sought advice from the NHS A&E and they were unable to diagnose anything specific other than PVD, vitreous detachment, and they said it should all be okay. And that went on from October 17 till the middle of 2018, when I really wasn't happy that my eyesight was how it should be.
And then how did your condition progress after that?
I went back to Nav Coley, who owns the Glasshouse Care Centre in Newport, who had seen me initially. And he looked and he said, "I can see something so large that I haven't seen before in your eye, and I'm not happy. So I'm going to refer you back to A&E and we'll get a recheck, re-examination done for you." That happened straight away. And after 2 or 3 weeks, they still came back and said, "You've got a slight thickening of the membrane, which causes it to pull at the retina and cause more of a PVD, but it'll go away." But then you get to a point, I think, where your gut says, something is not quite right and I need to get another opinion. And this is where it all changed. I went back to my own optician, Nav, and he said, "I'm really not happy with what you're being told. I think you need referring to a consultant. I'd like to refer you to Mr. Cam Balaghan. And because I'm really not happy, do you have private cover?"
Could he not have referred you on the NHS?
I could have been referred on the NHS. It was quite a long referral time. The NHS were saying, "We've done everything and we are convinced it's okay." What I now know they hadn't done was the second layer checks with the increased light in to find the tears.
So what happened next?
I saw Mr. Balaghan within literally a week and he looked at me and within very few minutes said, "You shouldn't be leaving here. I can see 2 retinal tears. They've not looked at that. You could sneeze, cough, fall, and that would effectively tear your retina or you would actually go blind."
So from there, what was your treatment?
Within, I think it was about a week, 10 days, Mr. Balaghan did 2 retinal laser repairs to the right eye. And he did make comment at the time that he could also see there were other issues and that the left eye also had some membrane damage. 83 days ago, I had surgery done by Mr. Balaghan, and it was quite complex. There were 6 different procedures carried out, and that was quite a lot of work.
What's your recovery been like now?
It's quite amazing. When I'm discharged from the hospital, I pick up a prescription, and that prescription was for 4 different types of eye drops. In all, 19 drops per day. And 82 days later, I have brilliant eyesight in the right eye, which has been operated on. And it is just absolutely unbelievable that when the gas bubble dispersed, if I put my hand over my right eye and I look through my left, that's just like looking through a magnolia sepia type picture. But with my right one, the brightness, it's just tremendous.
So I was going to ask you, what do you feel about the future?
I'm an incredibly positive person, Hilary, and I'm very positive. I just think that the big issue for me is that the right person can make the right decision and make a surgical procedure that regains your eyesight. But then it's up to the person concerned to actually take control of making sure they do their part, which is what I'm doing, taking the medication, taking the drops. I've written a blog on each day, how I felt, what happened, how the eyesight changes. It's nothing clever. It's just that at one point in my recovery, I remember the gas bubble got to a certain level and everything turned upside down because the prism effect of the gas bubble gave a momentary, the dog's walking upside down feeling. And that can be really scary. But if you read people who have been through it and you think, actually, I'm not alone, that's actually not scary, you'll get it right.
Andy, thanks so much for sharing everything with us and for giving back like this.
It's an absolute pleasure.
I'm delighted that Mr. Cam Balaghan is with me now. He's a consultant ophthalmologist specialising in vitreo retina and cataracts. Thanks for joining me, Cam.
Thank you for inviting me, Michelle.
Can we just start with the case study that we've just heard? Was Andy a typical case, do you think?
Andy clearly had issues with his macula. He developed initially floaters in his eye and then developed some distortion in his vision. So in terms of his condition, which was epiretinal membrane, that aspect of that was fairly normal. What was quite unusual about Andy, and this highlights a very important point when it comes to epiretinal membranes, is that he had another cause for his epiretinal membrane, and that was the development of peripheral retinal breaks, which, left untreated, could cause a retinal detachment in about 1/3 to 50% of cases. And this case therefore highlighted the significant importance of not just relying on an OCT scan, which we all do, but it highlights the importance of doing a thorough check to exclude all other causes of epiretinal membranes, which are less likely than an idiopathic epiretinal membrane, but ones that which must be excluded. And so I've taught for quite some time now that if you see a patient for the first time with a new epiretinal membrane, it's important to have a dilated fundus examination to exclude other causes. And in Andy's case, it's not clear if that was performed at the first visit, and that's even in the hospital eye department.
And just for the listener's benefit, what exactly is an epiretinal membrane?
So an epiretinal membrane, it's a membrane. So to patients, we describe it as scar tissue growing on the surface of the retina, so epi. And it's composed of many different cell types that result in the formation of a membrane that can be of variable thickness and severity. So on the very mild end of the spectrum, we tend to just call epiretinal membrane cellophane maculopathy, because it grows on the surface of the retina, it gives this glistening appearance on fundoscopy, but causes minimum disturbance to the anatomy of the macula. So these would be patients that have a visible ERM or cellophane and have no symptoms of reduced vision or distortion. If you take that to the other end of the spectrum, and it is a spectrum of severity, you can get very thick membranes growing on the surface of the macula, causing significant tractional edema of the macula, and maybe even some splitting of the retinal cells or schisis, and some disruption to the outer retina. So in these sorts of cases, we'd say that there's puckering of the macula, and we tend to call these macular puckers. But they're all one and the same. They're just different names given to epiretinal membranes of varying severities.
So is an epiretinal membrane a precursor to, or can it potentially be a precursor to vitreomacular traction?
So if the vitreous is still attached to the macula and there's visible traction with or without an epiretinal membrane, we would call that VMT. And there needs to be physical adhesion of the vitreous to the macula first to define it as being vitreomacular traction. But if you've got an epiretinal membrane as well, and there's still attachment of the vitreous, we would still call it VMT, but also in the presence of an epiretinal membrane.
And if someone does have vitreomacular traction, are they likely to have symptoms such as flashing lights because of that traction, because of the vitreous pulling on the retina?
That's a very, very good point. But surprisingly, most patients don't. Most patients either experience no symptoms. So it's amazing, and it still amazes me, how asymptomatic some patients can be despite a very impressive level of vitreomacular traction, not just habitually, but also when you give them an AMSLA chart.
That leads me on to the next condition, really. Quite a few of us as optometrists have encountered macular holes. So how would you describe the key diagnostic features of a macular hole?
So here, I think we need to recognise that we now have the advent of OCT and that classification systems have changed, both for macular hole and also for vitreomacular disorders overall, from being a fundoscopic-based classification, so the GAS system, you know, your stage 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4 classification system, which is all based on very good and accurate examination of the patient's fovea, to now an OCT-based classification system. So if we go on that, the definition of a full thickness macular hole is a full thickness foveal defect or lesion that interrupts all macular layers from the internal limiting membrane to the retinal pigment epithelium. So that's the definition. And how we then subclassify that, we classify it by its size, whether there's the presence or absence of vitreomacular traction, and also the cause. So the modern classification in terms of size, we would say, is it a small macular hole, i.e. less than 250 microns on OCT? Is it medium, between 250 and 400? Or is it large, which is over 400? And there's even some push now to extend that 400 limit even further. We also want to know, is there still vitreous attached to the macular hole or not? Because this actually influences some of the treatments that we may offer the patient. And then thirdly, what was the cause? Was it primary, i.e. initiated by the vitreomacular traction? Or was it secondary, which can be due to trauma or severe macular edema, for example? So there's other causes.
And I've also encountered lamellar holes. You can see the difference on OCT, but for patients, how do they differ in terms of symptoms?
The lamellar hole, first of all, the definition, lamellar means layer. And the IVTS classification of a lamellar hole is one that has a non-full thickness defect. Okay, so it can't be full thickness. It's got to have an irregular foveal contour, a defect in the inner fovea, which may or may not have loss of retinal tissue. You may get splitting of the layers between the outer plexiform and the outer nuclear layer. But importantly, there's minimal disruption to the outer photoreceptor layer. So you can expect some distortion, some reduction of vision. But compared with a full thickness macular hole, the distortion tends to be less. The visual acuity tends to be better. And there usually isn't a complete loss of very central vision, because the photoreceptors are still present in the foveolar region. We have to also say that many patients are asymptomatic of lamellar holes because the reduction in vision may be very slight and it may be their non-dominant eye. And also when some conditions develop very chronically, patients tend to become less aware of it. And of course, it also depends on the patient and their visual requirements. So we have to bear that in mind as well, is the asymptomatic patient, because it strongly influences whether we actually do anything with the patient or not, surgically.
Thanks, Cam. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists, and that's where we want to hear from you. If there's a topic you want us to cover, or have a fascinating case you want to share, email us podcast@docket.info or tweet @soundoptometry. Cam, optometrists are acutely aware of the current NHS backlog and want to make sure that they're making the right referral decisions. So I want to explore how optometrists should decide which patients should be referred to ophthalmology. So how do vitreoretinal conditions tend to progress? At what point should they be referred rather than just be monitored?
This is a very important point, particularly so because now many practices have OCT, which opens up the exciting prospect of community management of some of these disorders. So in terms of whether you refer or not, and also how urgently you refer a vitreomacular patient with a surgical vitreomacular problem of the types that we've discussed, very much depends on the condition itself, because these different conditions have different prognoses and different management. So let's take the example of a patient and they have no or minimal symptoms. We can be confident that it's just an epiretinal membrane and there aren't any symptoms. And therefore, there isn't really any need to refer to hospitalized services because we're not going to do anything. However, if that patient had a retinal tear as the cause, or other causes, then that would change the referral priority. So clearly that's someone you would want to discuss fairly soon or urgently with your local ophthalmology department. So we want to operate only if the patient is having a problem and wants to get better when it comes to epiretinal membranes. Slightly different to that is the condition macular hole. So with full thickness macular holes, there is an element of urgency not just to the referral, but to the surgical intervention. If you see a patient with a macular hole, you do need to refer. Put on your referral that it's a macular hole and request an appointment as soon as possible. The vitreoretinal surgeon on the other end of the referral will see that this is a macular hole and try and prioritize that patient for an appointment as soon as possible in their clinic.
And if an optometrist has referred a patient to the hospitalised service, and at the moment there can be quite a long delay, particularly if it's not an urgent referral, like, for example, for a macular hole, if it's less urgent and the patient is on a waiting list, is there anything that the optometrist can do while the patient is waiting to be seen?
Yes. So in the context of, say, an epiretinal membrane, first of all, you can explain to the patient the prognosis. You've got a baseline scan, which would be important. And whilst the patient is waiting for surgery, if the patient wishes, they could see the optometrist again for another OCT scan, either to confirm that there's stability or progression. And if, say, that community optometrist finds that the epiretinal membrane is progressing and the visual acuity is reducing, they then have the option of writing back to their hospital eye department saying that the acuity is getting worse and the membrane is getting worse. And that may then influence the consultant there to prioritize that patient maybe slightly differently. The other option, of course, is if there are very long waiting times in the NHS, which is very common at the moment, particularly as a result of the pandemic, then we have to ethically offer the patient all available options. And so if the NHS has a long wait, the only other option is to go privately and to at least offer the patient that. And then it's down to the patient if they wish to pursue that option or not, which would result, of course, in being seen much earlier and potentially having surgery earlier if that is an option for the patient.
So Cam, if you find as an optometrist that a patient does have an epiretinal membrane, perhaps it's the first presentation and you don't think it's very severe yet and you don't think it warrants actually any treatment, and you decide to monitor the patient yourself in practice, perhaps because you have an OCT, how often should you recall that patient for monitoring? Is it a case of giving them a regular routine appointment, or do they bring them back sooner, or do they wait for the patient to have evidence of progression?
That's a very good point. And it's really exciting times in that we can now, for the first time, monitor and manage many of these vitreomacular patients in the community, because you now have that technology in the community. So if we take an epiretinal membrane patient who only has minimal symptoms, maybe a very slight reduction in their visual acuity, and it's clear that they don't want to have any intervention or wouldn't benefit from an intervention, then I think if it's the first time you've detected the epiretinal membrane, I think it's very reasonable to see that patient at the 3 to 4 month interval and to see if there's been progression, not just on the OCT, but also in terms of their symptoms. And the usual mantra of the longer something is stable, the more the interval can be extended, I think would apply here. So if they're completely stable at 3 months and there's been no change at all, you could then extend it to 6 months and then yearly. And if after yearly follow-up, you're absolutely clear that there's been no change whatsoever and there's no significant worsening of symptoms, then just seeing the patient as part of their normal recall, I think, would be quite appropriate. Of course, this would apply to epiretinal membranes rather than macular holes, which, symptoms or not, you're going to refer. But for epiretinal membranes that are very common, I think that's an entirely appropriate management, with the caveat being that these are idiopathic epiretinal membranes and you've at least had an attempt to exclude more sinister pathology causing that epiretinal membrane.
And if someone has vitreomacular traction or VMT, again, is it quite safe to monitor that as well?
Yes. With vitreomacular traction, currently we would intervene if the patient has symptoms and wants to have something done. So you can be quite surprised how asymptomatic some VMT patients can be when you look at their scans. We're not going to treat the scan, we're going to treat the patient. So if you remember that, if the patient has no symptoms at all and they have VMT, then I'm not going to give them an invasive procedure to just relieve the appearance of an OCT scan. So if you're just monitoring this patient in practice, I think an initial 3 month review is appropriate. So see them again in 3 months and rescan and ask about those symptoms again. And again, the longer it remains stable, the more you can extend that follow up period.
Yes. How would you recommend optometrists deal with patients when they have multiple pathologies? So the example I'm thinking of is if a patient presents and really is struggling with their vision and they've got, for example, cataract, but they've also got an epiretinal membrane that appears to be stable.
Think about the symptoms. So if the patient reports just cataract symptoms, so foggy vision, they're not specifically reporting distortion, they're not specifically reporting a smudge in their central vision, and or the epiretinal membrane looks very mild on the OCT scan, then it's very reasonable to refer just to your local cataract provider and to the cataract service, because the epiretinal membrane in those cases is therefore very likely to be insignificant. If, however, the patient is describing foggy vision, and when you specifically ask the patient about distortion and they clearly tell you they're having distortion as well as foggy vision or central smudge in their vision, then that would be more appropriately dealt with by a vitreoretinal surgeon, because we can do the two operations at the same time. We'll do the cataract and the epiretinal membrane simultaneously, and therefore resulting in quicker visual rehabilitation overall. The key thing here is you've got to ask about those symptoms.
So, Cam, that cataract is just an example of a coexisting pathology that you may find with an epiretinal membrane. But when we heard Andy's case early, he had a different pathology. He had a retinal tear or a couple of retinal tears. So that's when it's really important, isn't it, to find out what it is that the patient's actually experiencing.
Yes, Andy's an excellent case in this regard. It completely changes your referral urgency. and your priority. So let's say, for example, he just had an OCT scan, was never dilated, and it was simply referred as an epiretinal membrane. He would have got a completely routine appointment at his local vitreoretinal service. And by that time, there's a possibility that he could have suffered a detached retina, which could have been avoided if it had a full, thorough, dilated examination at the outset. So you can see how in his particular case, it can substantially change what you as a community optometrist would do with that patient. Do you refer or not? And also, how quickly do you refer that patient or not?
Thank you. So, Cam, what is your final take-home message for optometrists when dealing with vitreo macular conditions?
My final take-home message would be try and put all the information you've gathered about that patient from the perspective of symptoms, from your fundoscopic findings, and to your OCT scans. Try and put all that information together and develop a whole picture about this patient. Don't refer a patient just on the basis of a symptom, on the basis of the OCT scan. So I think it's really crucial that you pattern recognize the fundoscopic appearances of the different vitreomacular conditions, because that's what we did before OCT came out. And then also pattern recognize what the OCT features are, because we still get some patients that filter through to our wet macular degeneration service, for example, referred as wet macular degeneration, but they have a bond or obvious macular hole. And you don't need OCT to differentiate a macular hole from wet AMD. So it's really important to take ownership as an optometrist, and that would really help us in hospitalized services as well. So patient, your examination, OCT findings, put everything together and make that decision.
Mr. Cam Balaghan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. If you would like more information, go to our website, docket.info, and search for Sound Optometry to find the additional reading materials. By listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain 1 point covering communication, standards of practice, and ocular disease. We'd really appreciate it if you spread the word about the podcast, tell your colleagues to listen, or subscribe to the series so you don't miss an episode. We'll be taking a month off now for Christmas, but we are looking forward to welcoming you back for more CPD in the new year, starting with an episode looking at prescribing PRISM for binocular vision anomalies. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.